Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello, you're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. Hugo Rifkin here, filling in for Matt Chorley today. Coming up on today's podcast, it's 60 years since Martin Luther King Jr. made his famous I Have a Dream speech. But what made that speech so good? And how can today's politicians learn from the great speeches from history? But first, it's time for the columnists. We're talking Theresa May and much else besides with Libby Purvis from The Times and The Telegraph's Zoe Strimple.
The columnists on Times Radio.
So I'm joined by The Times columnist Libby Purvis. Hello, Libby.
Hello.
How are you? You well?
Yes, bank holiday Monday, but
always a joy.
Working.
And The Telegraph columnist Zoe Strimple. Hello, Zoe.
Hi, Hugo.
Fancy meeting you here. How are you doing?
We have to start meeting like this. I'm all right, a bit tired.
Yep, good. Well, thanks for being here. Much appreciated. Let's dive into some of the topics we want to look at this morning. First up, Theresa May. Yes, Theresa May has written a book. It's out next month. It's called The Abuse of Power. And in it, she defines the abuse of power is something she defines as institutions of the state and people who work in institutions of the state. No, that's not right at all. Institutions of the state and people who work with them, putting themselves first, way ahead of the people they are there to serve, I think is what she means. There's an extract in today's Times, and she's done an interview with the Sunday Times as well, available with a digital subscription on the website. Zoe, are you going to be reading this book? Are you as excited as I am by that Theresa May has finally broken her silence?
I mean, I'm sort of semi-excited. I would probably read it. I will probably read it. It does sound intriguing. I like that she's just going in on a sort of hatchet job rather than trying to sort of make it about her personal biography, although I see from the extract that there's plenty of that as well. So I think it sounds worth reading, but also not. I'm not going to say I think I'm going to think it's the most thrilling thing ever. I mean, her points are, I do find books about selfishness a bit boring. Okay. selfish. Everyone's so selfish.
Is that a paradox? I'm trying to figure that out. No, sorry. Go on.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure. And we'll get to this if we discuss another book, but Danny Kruger's book as well. And also corruption in politics. This is a really important point. However, I think just based on a brief glance, she's coming at it from a bit of a heavy-handed sort of monotone, which I think might be a little over the top. I mean, she says, you know, she's seen the abuse of power at its worst among our parliamentarians. I think if you were to look at, you know, a few other countries, you might see the abuse of power at its worst. I think it's relatively on the global scale, small fry in Britain, but that doesn't mean there isn't a problem with our political culture in general. So I would be more interested to know how it came to feel that we have mediocrities who are all, you know, chasing their tails around as our entire political culture, rather than corruption being Britain's first and foremost problem. I think the final thing I would say is that I feel like I've read a lot of Dominic Cummings on how terrible, self-serving, counterproductive and stupid the government is, alongside there being some, you know, very good eggs, very talented people. So I'm wondering, like, what the fresh angle is going to be, really.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Look, Libby, as Home Secretary and then Prime Minister, May was in charge for Windrush and Grenfell and the Brexit stalemate that followed the referendum. In one of the quotes from today's extract on the latter, we get the line, "Aha, I hear you exclaim she's trying to blame others for her own mistakes. I'm not. What I want to do is show how the power plays in Parliament contributed to the stalemate that ensured it, until it was broken by the general election of 2019. So, I mean, basically what she's doing is she's looking for sort of institutional reasons for her own failure. Do you think that's reasonable?
Not entirely, but I am always interested to hear a new voice about what is really going on and why it goes wrong. You know, we tend to hear the very sort of loud and popular and sort of self-seeking voices. I mean, Dominic Cummings to go on and on about how people are sort of out for their own ends, I find a bit ripe. But I'm interested in what she says. I think her attacks on John Bercow are riveting and useful, because we've all sort of rather forgotten he existed now, but he did do a certain amount of damage. And I think we've been short of senior politicians who are serious and well-meaning and modest and not self-seeking. I mean, I suppose the nearest right to the top looks like Rishi Sunak, and he's probably going to unravel as the election gets closer. But I think Theresa May seems to me a decent person, and her voice needs to be heard, even though we may disagree with some of it.
I mean, you're right that the fact that she focuses on Bercow is very interesting, because, I mean, I think I would have thought of Theresa May, and I think maybe we remember Theresa May as somebody who was brought down by harder Brexiters, brought down by the likes of Boris Johnson, who succeeded her, brought down by not being able to steer her own party, whereas her views very much seems to be, at least from the extracts, that she was actually sort of brought down by the sly non-cooperation of the Remainer faction led by the Speaker, right, Libby?
Well, I rather hope that she's going to say rather more in the book when it comes out about the Remainer faction, because the damage that has been done by that blocking, the damage that has been done to our relationship ongoing with Europe, you know, the damage that has been done to the economy by that faction, you know, which would not accept the referendum, I think is immense. And I'd like to hear more on that.
Sure. Look, Libby, sticking with you, let's turn to your column in the paper this week. Well, today, indeed, this morning, in the Times comment section. Subscribers, do have a look, which concerns another political book, this time from the Conservative backbencher Danny Kruger. What's the argument he makes in his book, roughly?
Well, it's interesting. I've been sort of bickering below the line with people who simply won't read it because they hate Danny Kruger. But I think ideas which are sort of bravely and strongly expressed and which come from someone, some of whose other views you don't like, you know, still should be paid attention to. And I thought the book was riveting. It is about the idea of a good society and how, in many ways, government policy actually militates against a lot of the things which most people find sustaining in their lives and work, you know, the family and marriage and rooted communities, and that the state spends a lot to take responsibilities off people and to tell them what's best, and it doesn't really value the important people who hold society together, teachers and prison officers and carers and so on. But if half his points and wishes and ideas were being brought to us by Labour or the Lib Dems in the very sort of strong terms, okay, rather religious terms that he brings them, it would be rather refreshing. But instead, they're coming from a Tory backbencher. And he's a decent man. You know, he when he was very young, he founded a very good prison charity. That's how the only time I've ever met him was over that. You know, and I think we should listen. And I don't like some of the sense that we're getting back of, we shouldn't listen because he's a Tory. We shouldn't listen because he said dubious things about abortion rights. You know, no, we should listen to anybody. It's the same as with Theresa May, really. I'm just being very mild and vanilla here.
Zoe, does the state and the government have any business talking about values and virtues in this kind of way? Sort of telling us the shape of how we ought to live rather than just providing the conditions for us to do so?
I don't like it. I think in as much as it would be nice for the government to have a set of coherent political ideas, I would be keen on that. But what I'm hearing in the Kruger book is something akin to what I've been hearing more and more among the new sort of the resurgent right of you know, partly of the Tories, but also the kind of national conservatism crowd, who are very keen that, you know, everybody fulfills this kind of idea of almost like a sort of top-down enforced community. I don't know. To me, it began with this kind of, well, this has been going on for millennia, but a distrust of this sort of cosmopolitan, international, global type of person. And speaking as a deeply cosmopolitan, international, global Jew, I'm made very uncomfortable by these sort of, we should really be getting closer. It's very Volkish. We should be getting closer and closer to our communities. And actually, again, I'm going to just speak personally and try to widen out. But during COVID, you know, people talked about how wonderful it was to be sort of thrown upon their communities. And I have a very sort of hundreds of people that live around a communal garden with mixed housing. Some is social housing, some is key worker housing. And there was a lot of community. And after 2 months of lockdown, I began to be absolutely, I could not bear another day of seeing the same, you know, it began to make me feel completely claustrophobic, and I craved getting back out into the kind of global.
You should read his actual book. I mean, I think I like what you're saying, which is that basically society should be absolutely organized around people like you who are really bored of their neighbors. I can kind of relate to that.
I need the option. I suppose I just get very, I get antsy when I can fit something into this more, for me, local.
But don't, honestly, give him a chance. Read the actual book, and you'll hate bits of it, and bits of it you'll really like.
I completely agree with you, Libby, that one should completely read these things. And he's a Tory, it's absolutely no issue to me. But, you know, I suppose I'm curious, Libby, if you do feel that this is sort of so new, because I know David Goodhart has just written a book basically along these lines, that we should value care workers and we should make it easier for women essentially to stay at home with children. And I suppose my, you know, the final really bit of discomfort I have with Kruger's, it appears to be Kruger's entire vision. I know that you say, Libby, that he's impatient with the Dickensian idea of the angel in the home. But so often what these arguments add up to, and what I've been hearing recently, also I think what David Goodhart's interesting book also suggests, is that really it's quote unnatural for women to be working when they're mothers of young children.
He's totally not saying that, honestly. Right. The trouble is there's loonies on both sides of anything. You know, there's the Ayn Rand loonies one side, and there's the kind of some rather odd numbers of the new conservatives on the other side. And you just have to, you know, you have to not judge people by the loonies who agree with them.
It's literally what I do for a living, I feel. Look, Libby, something that sort of always bothers me here, and look, I haven't read the book, you have read the book, so you can set me straight if I'm getting this wrong. But when conservatives in particular talk about the values of marriage, the importance of marriage, of caring roles and all that kind of stuff, I always think there's something that always bothers me about the way that, look, surely if you want to champion marriage, one way you do about that is by banging on about marriage and perhaps even tax incentives for marriage and all that, and just making marriage the focus point. Another way you do that is by thinking about the conditions that exist within society, that if you want people to live in a traditional way, that allow them to do so. So you think about the way that, for example, it's virtually impossible for a couple with children to be a single earning couple these days. Certainly,
but
in most of our major
cities. That's what he's saying. It's full of policy. I mean, there are policy points in it. There are policies about taxation and so on. You know, he does actually address some of this, though not in huge detail.
But Libby, is it policy in terms of, like, if we build it in policy terms, then it will come? As in, if we create these situations, then people will marry, they will stay together, they will have stable family units? Or is it taking that kind of sort of that sort of talismanic thing of marriage?
No, I don't think he's being talismanic, actually. I think he does. He talks about the conditions which government creates, the taxation, the detail of taxation, which government has, which makes it harder and harder. I mean, the housing disaster. You know, he talks about the way that his government, the lot that he's in, have sucked up to the huge house builders who like to keep the prices high. You know, they like to build in places where the prices are going to be high rather than in places where the prices will be lower. You know, and he talks about the housing crisis. He doesn't talk in immense detail about everything, but honestly, just give him the credit at least that he's not doing the back to basics. You know, why aren't you all decent people and stay married? You know, he's not doing that. And remember, I mean, he was a huge backer of Boris for a long, long time. He defended him, so he can't be that much of a virtue fascist, can he?
Isn't his goal, Libby? Basically, you know, he seems very preoccupied with knowing what makes people happy, and that the government should be working to those ends. But again, I mean, he's saying he'd like to go back to before the 1950s, but people were absolutely miserable. I thought that's what he... How does he know what makes people happy? I don't know. I think there's a problem with pinning all of the woes of the day on things that are actually amazing. I think the kind of freedom to come in and out of communities. I agree that there's some, you know, the effects of the market have left people feeling desperate, especially in housing. But also, you know, I suppose I just miss the days of a more robust Tory defense of, you know, how profit and markets might fit with this. And I think Kruger represents this.
Let's hear it from money and fecklessness is what Zoe's saying. I've decided. Look, I think we're making an excellent argument that people should at the very least read Libby's column in the opinion section in the Times today. Let's talk about Keir Starmer now and whether he's posh. His own director of strategy has said that he's viewed as off the scale posh by Red Wall voters. Starmer has, of course, been keen to stress his working class roots, speaking about experiencing poverty while growing up. Just last week, he said he wouldn't have been able to afford to go to university, and he regularly refers to his father's trade as a toolmaker and his mother's career as a nurse and so on. But he's insisted he's also proud of his honour, his knighthood, and of his parents' pride in seeing him knighted at Buckingham Palace. The Conservatives, of course, have attempted to use Starmer's title and former profession to cast him as part of the elite. Indeed, this is a man who was a sort of, you know, top London lawyer for decades and was allegedly also the inspiration for Mr. Darcy in Bridget Jones. So he's not unposh, but Libby, is it a problem?
It's a terrible problem. I mean, the idea that a knighthood makes you posh is quite funny anyway, but our class system or our mental...
Can I just pick you up on that? You think a knighthood doesn't make you posh?
No, of course it doesn't.
Right.
No.
Go on. Right.
No, it means you got a knighthood for something. You did something. I mean, it doesn't mean that anymore because people get terrible decorations for all sorts of things. I mean, peers.
But you don't think you become posh with a knighthood. Anyway, sorry,
no,
you were saying.
I don't think you do, but I think every country's got a ridiculous sort of class system. You know, America's got rednecks versus preppies, and the French know exactly who is bon chic, bon genre. But we are particularly awful in Britain. And I think it's a great problem the way we think too much about class, and it even works in a sort of inverted sense. In that, you know, some people, he's an honest chap, you know, just because he talks rough, you know, and comes from a rough background, and it led in inversely to Boris getting a lot of his fan base just by being a PG Woodhouse character and therefore a joke and therefore a good guy because he was a joke, because we like jokes, you know. And I think Boris got too far on that with the sort of inverted snobbery, and I think it's all nonsense. It just really is, and we need to grow out of it, but it's very hard for any nation to grow out of it. You know, class systems are, you know, they're just so hardwired into us. But of course it's nonsense. He's not a bit posh, Starmer. He's a bit of a parvenu, frankly, darling. Absolutely.
What do you reckon, Zoe?
Well, I think even if he was posh and was good, that would be completely fine. And I agree with everything Libby said, actually. But I think I go even further and say I don't like any sort of... it's a question of... It's interesting when sort of men talk about abortion rights and things, is that more of a problem? But I'm thinking in general, I like to argue that any kind of identity is not relevant. What's relevant is what somebody is saying, what they're doing, and the degree to which they limit hypocrisy in their own life to the best that they can. So I'm with Libby. I think it's sort of tiresome and disappointing. Is it really about the class system, though? I'm not 100% sure. I think it's more of a sort of... It's like we don't know quite how to judge politicians now, because it's not 100% clear what they're actually selling and what they're about. So you kind of fall back on these personal attributes.
That's interesting.
I think there's you know, what disturbs me about people fixating on this is that I think there's an anti-intellectualism, obviously, that underpins that.
I think that's precisely right. I also think I'd quite like him to say, you know what, I am posh. I was a lawyer for years and I got a knighthood. Yeah. Well done me. Yeah. Anyway, exactly. let's move on. Let's talk about clothing at festivals, which I'm very excited about because I'm actually going to a festival after I come off air today. There we go. Traders at Reading Festival and fans are openly defying one of its rules, which bans clothing that, and I quote, promotes cultural appropriation. The event, run by Festival Republic states that some various items that can't be taken onto the campsite or arena, and they include clothing or garments which promote cultural appropriation, and alongside anything that could reasonably be used as a weapon. But people are selling, and more shame on them, wearing elephant print harem pants, Native American ponchos, and apparently authentic yak wool Tibetan shawls. Zoe, is this an outrage, or are these just like good stuff to wear in the outdoors?
I mean, I don't think they're good stuff to wear. By any, I mean, it's obviously cringe.
I'd love a poncho. I'm always jealous men can't wear ponchos. Some. What do you mean you think I have some?
Sure I've seen you in a poncho. No, I don't think it's an outrage. It's clearly not an outrage. I think the whole thing about cultural appropriation is toxic, ridiculous, and completely shows it's just something that has nothing to do with the matter at hand. And you know, if you're going to express disdain for another culture, you're not going to do it by showing you think it's so cool that you want to have it all over, you know, you want to be decked out in it. Also, you know, in a festival context, I mean, the whole, I take my hat off to you, Hugo, for going to a festival at I'm not going to say it,
our age.
I think it's ridiculous. I think more broadly, the point has to be that culture exists through various forms of, you know, is built on, and creativity is all about it. I personally would be delighted if non-Jews started wearing Stars of David. I was trying to think, would I like it if they were wearing like the full garb, like at synagogue? Maybe less, but maybe so. If they're showing that they think it's cool, that would be great.
That would be interesting if that was the new festival look. Libby, I didn't really understand the point about cultural appropriation. I didn't think it was reasonable until I saw a photo of what was her name? Susan Boyle, the singer, wearing an Indian headdress at Tea in the Park. And I was like, oh no, I get it now. This can be offensive. What do you think?
Oh, I don't think it is. I think imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. And I think we should stand up for the right of a pasty-faced, wannabe cool, middle-class, middle-aged people to wear Rasta hats, Aztec poncho, elephant print trousers, and quite possibly sort of curly-toed Islamic sandals at the same time. I'm absolutely all for it. And also, what you've got to remember is a lot of this stuff is actually very, very cheap. I mean, it has come from, obviously, sweatshops often in countries far away. And that's one of the reasons that people buy something brightly coloured and jolly and wear it at a festival, is because it will get so muddy and disgusting they'll probably throw it away afterwards. You know, that's not a good thing ecologically, but on the other hand, it's sort of practical. And I think the hypocrisy of Festival Republic, of all people, deciding to ban cultural appropriation in any form is just astonishing.
That was Libby Purvis and Zoe Strimple. Remember, you can read Libby in The Times every week. Just go to thetimes.co.uk/timesredbox and get yourself a digital subscription.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
You're listening to the Times Red Box Politics Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
So, 60 years ago today, the civil rights activist Martin Luther King stood in front of 250,000 people on the steps of the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., and made a speech that would change the course of American history.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah.
Joining me are Phil Collins, who was once Tony Blair's chief speechwriter, Jessica Cunniff, David Cameron's speechwriter, and Chris Wilkins, chief speechwriter for Theresa May. Morning, all. Hope you're well. Let's start with Martin Luther King. Phil, I'll come to you first. This speech was partially improvised. King drew together sections from other speeches he's made over the previous few years. Does that make it a bit of a cheat, or is that just to be expected?
No, it wasn't to be expected at all. In fact, it was his team were really irritated with him for doing it, because they all insisted that they write a brand new speech for the big occasion in Washington. And if you go to YouTube, you can actually see the speech that they wrote. It's called The Cancel Check, and it's the first 12 minutes. But it doesn't really go down all that well. It's fine, but it's a bit flat. And so what happened is that there was a gospel singer called Mahalia Jackson, who traveled with the King entourage. She's behind him on the podium, and she whispers to him at a certain point, "Tell them about the dream, Martin. Tell them about the dream." So he goes to his stock of phrases he's got in his mind from being a preacher around the circuit, and he does start to do it extempore. And that's absolutely ludicrous thing to do. You never advise anybody to do that. You're totally off script. And exactly when this happened, one of his speechwriters, Walker Wyatt, turned to his colleague and he said, "Oh no, he's doing the dream," which is probably the worst judgment of any speech that's ever been uttered. So it was a completely, it was improvised and it wasn't expected. And so that clip you just played, which is part of perhaps the greatest passage of rhetoric in modern politics, was not improvised in the sense that he'd said similar things before, but it certainly wasn't intended to have been said on that occasion.
That is an amazing thing to learn. Jess, talk us through the sort of the technical details on this speech, the use of rhetoric, the biblical references and so on. Why is it such a good example of how to write a speech?
It's a fantastic example, Hugo. I think, as Phil said, it's the best in kind of modern times. I think what Martin Luther King does so successfully is he connects with his audience, and you have to listen to it. You listen back to it and you hear the sort of interaction with the audience to the point where they're kind of directing him and egging him on. How does he connect with them? I think the most powerful way is that use of metaphor. You know, every abstract concept that he talks about is linked to a real thing. You know, he describes justice as a bright day. He talks about injustice as quicksand. These are all sort of concrete things that we know, and people in the audience, people beyond that immediate audience, and people today can still understand and still resonates with people. So it's the way he uses language, and particularly metaphor and imagery, I think, that really connected with people. You know, people make a lot of the musicality of the speech, and it is, you listen to the thing in its entirety and it's like a song. It builds and builds to the climax, to the peroration at the end. It's a masterpiece. It is like a song, but it's also like a picture. I mean, it's image after image that he provides us with, and I think that's why it still kind of works today and why it's an absolutely fantastic example of rhetoric.
And Chris, is this the sort of speech that you'd study when writing your own speeches, or is context very important? You know, prime ministers have to make so many speeches, and if you end up delivering the sort of the I have a dream type speech when you're, I don't know, sort of in front of audio representatives in Sunderland or something, I mean, does that work, or can you always turn to a great speech in order to seek inspiration?
Well, certainly when trying to prepare for a big speech for, say, Theresa or anyone else I've written for, you do go back and look at other speeches and seek inspiration. That's absolutely the case. But I think it would be rather hubristic to say this is a speech that you can look at too closely, because it was of its time when it was delivered by an incredible individual, and would that we all had the opportunity to write for people like Martin Luther King. But there are some things you could take from it, and Jess has talked about the sort of technical aspects of it, which you can definitely lean on. I think one thing I always talk about when trying to teach people now about speech writing is to really think about start by thinking about the headline that you want at the end of this speech. What is it that you want somebody to write about the speech you have written? And although maybe he improvised it, you know, here there was that clear theme, that clear message. I have a dream, an incredible line really to take from the speech. So there are elements you can take from it, and definitely you always go back and look at speeches, but as I think the context of this was the real thing. It was a great speech, brilliantly delivered, but the context of all the people on the Mall there in Washington, of the moment when it was looking at the legislation to end, to enhance civil rights, etc., the context was one thing that made this speech so utterly memorable, I think.
Let's move on to some other great examples of great political speeches, and we obviously couldn't not include this one.
Let us, therefore, brace ourselves to our duties and so bear ourselves that if the British Empire and its Commonwealth last for 1,000 years, men will still say this was their finest hour.
That's, of course, Winston Churchill's finest hour, and we could probably have chosen any of Churchill's wartime speeches. Jess, what makes Churchill such a great speechwriter?
Well, the interesting thing, Hugo, is that Churchill didn't love writing speeches or making speeches to begin with, but he worked and worked and worked at it. And he, I think, wrote most of his own speeches, and he would work on them sort of in the bath and in bed, and he would dictate a lot of it. I think what made him a great speaker was that he practiced and he learned his craft, and he was obviously taught rhetoric. He knew a lot about the tools and tricks of the trade. But again, it sort of comes back to that Martin Luther King point, as he really knew how to connect with people, and he knew sort of the right words for the right moments. He, you know, used the sort of metaphors that we've talked about before very vividly in his "We Will Fight on the Beaches" speech. He also used quite a lot of humour, which you don't really kind of consider would be a thing during wartime. But everything he did kind of connected with his audience, not just if he was speaking to the Commons, but the sort of wider audience of the public, and even beyond that, you know, to countries overseas, wanted the message to ring out, you know, as far as America in terms of what he was saying. So he was very aware of his audience. He knew what he was doing with his craft. And the main thing is he practiced and he practiced and practiced.
Chris, Churchill's words, they're now sort of embedded in the British psyche. We'll always have them in there. What is it about them that has sort of planted them there? How did he manage to pull that off?
Well, I think, again, context obviously matters. He was speaking at the moments of national crisis, and so they embed themselves anyway. He also had this incredibly distinctive voice, which helps to embed these language in a way that you know, if you had a more sort of a less recognizable voice, then it would probably wouldn't be so effective. But he, and Jess is right about him rehearsing and practicing everything, but again, just the way he used language to capture moments. There's this clip that you just played there, where he uses the phraseology of lettuce, where he's imploring people to sort of get on board with him, to join a mission and things like that. And he would do things like that. And then speak to that greater national moment, you know, finest hour, etc. These things that speak to actually bringing people together. And I think that's something that means that they do stick in the consciousness when you are imploring to unity and trying to bring people together, something maybe we could learn rather more about these days in politics. That's the kind of thing that means actually many, many people can find something in those speeches to cling on to, because they are a point of unity.
Phil, could anyone have made Churchill's speeches, or is it important that he made them? Could he have written them for someone else? Would they have worked? What's the link between the speaker and the speech?
Well, they could have worked, but I mean, it's always been the case that politicians have had speechwriters ever since the Emperor Nero employed Seneca as his speechwriter. So it's not a novelty. I quite often do a sort of double act with Mary Beard, where she thinks that everything that's gone wrong in politics derives from the moment that politicians stop writing their own speeches. So speechwriters are to blame for the decline of politics. But needless to say, I don't agree with that, and I doubt Chris or Jess will either. Though clearly you need to write for that person. I mean, the biggest separation, successful separation between the two, I think, is Peggy Noonan and Ronald Reagan, where Reagan is a great speaker because he was a wonderful actor. And Peggy Noonan is, you know, the doyenne of modern speechwriters. Usually the relationship is much closer in that Peggy wrote and Ronald spoke, whereas with Ted Sorensen and John F. Kennedy, for example, and with most other relationships, less celebrated, it's really intimate. It's really close. They're there together all the time. There's a great privilege of being the speechwriter is that you do have to be present all the time to kind of work, get into the idiom and the language. So it's almost always collaborative. And there's almost always loads of people involved in the speech, far too many, in fact, usually. Part of the task is to keep people at bay and to be the editor-in-chief. So it, I wouldn't say just anybody could have done it, because clearly there was a courage in Churchill, which is substantive and material about what he really thought. And quite a lot of his party didn't think that stuff. But he didn't necessarily have to be his own writer. And he was unusual in that. In that he was such a inveterate writer of speeches. And he, you know, in his early career, he was regarded as slightly ridiculous because he lavished rhetorical constructions on things that weren't worth it. There's a lovely story about him as a by-election candidate in Oldham in 1899. He stands in an empty church hall and he says, "Never before in the history of Lancashire have so many people of Oldham had so much to eat." And it's exactly the same construction that you get in 1940, but of course it's absurd.
Yeah.
Which just goes to show that context.
Yeah, sure. Well, look, let's jump forward a bit and let's take a listen to Margaret Thatcher's party conference speech in 1984, which was, of course, made on the same day as an IRA bomb attack at the Grand Hotel, where Thatcher and other cabinet ministers had been staying during the conference.
And the fact that we are gathered here now, shocked, but composed and determined, is a sign not only that this attack has failed, but that all attempts to destroy democracy by terrorism will fail.
I mean, talk about rising to the occasion. Chris, look, making or producing a speech like that in such circumstances, knowing that you've got to sort of go out and give it, what do you turn to when you've got to sort of respond to something as on the nose as that?
Yeah, it's... I guess the great challenge as a speechwriter, and when I was in Downing Street, I had to, unfortunately, on a number of occasions, write speeches for the Prime Minister in response to terrorist attacks. And, you know, they are some speeches you labour over weeks and you know, go through lots of drafts, et cetera, et cetera. And in moments like this, you do just have to respond slightly on the cuff. And at that point, I think what Phil was just talking about really matters, which is knowing intimately the person you are writing for. You know, you've got to think, what is it that they want to say instantly, off the cuff, from the heart? What is their instinctive response to this situation they are in? Again, typically in moments like that, you want to portray a unifying message because you know that people are fearful, so you're trying to bring people together. So that's almost the core of what you have to do. But then you also have to find a way to sort of move on beyond that moment, interpret it, but then move on so that you're not dwelling on kind of what's happened. And I think that clip you've just played there about, you know, not only has it failed this time, but the attempts will always fail, is trying to take the specific and make a more general point. And that's kind of the technique for moments like that in crisis. Bring people together and then try and use that to move on to something beyond the particular moment.
Let's take a listen now to a speech made by Thatcher's political rival Neil Kinnock that was made a few days before the 1992 election.
Margaret Thatcher wins on Thursday. I warn you not to be ordinary. I warn you not to be young. I warn you not to fall ill. And I warn you not to grow old.
Sorry, that's, excuse me, that's 83, not 92, my mistake. Phil, why does that work so well? Is it the repetition? Is it the sort of the foreboding, I warn you nature of it? What's happening there?
Yeah, it's both those things, I think. It is the technique we're very familiar with of repetition, which goes all the way back to Cicero and Aristotle, and he does that beautifully. I think it's also his voice. I mean, Kinnock has an English, but also, I think that speech and all of Kinnock's speeches in a way, and I'm an enormous fan of Neil Kinnock as a speaker, but they show the limits of speeches as well, because Neil Kinnock didn't become Prime Minister. You know, he was, if it were a contest for who were the best speaker, for a debating competition, Neil Kinnock would have won, but he didn't win. The Labour Party lost, and all of his speeches were magnificently effective within the Labour Party, like his famous speech in Bournemouth where he expelled militant. And there were great rallying cries for the faithful, but they didn't extend beyond. So I have to say there's a failure rhetorically there to extend the audience, which is also something you're always trying to do. And when you're writing for a prime minister, as we've all done, you are, in theory at least, trying to write for the widest possible audience, not just the people who already agree with you. You know that not everyone's going to listen, but you're trying to extend beyond. And that's something that Kinnock didn't manage to do in that speech.
That's interesting. Let's listen to David Cameron's bid for the Conservative Party leadership in 2005, a speech called Change to Win.
And let the message go out from this conference that a modern, compassionate conservatism is right for our times, right for this new generation, right for our party, and right for our country. And if we have the courage to grab it, to seize it, the bravery to fight for it with every ounce of vigour and passion in our bodies, nothing and no one will stop us. Thank you.
Jess, you suggested this one. I remember the contest. It was close, but not that he was the leading candidate. What I mean is this the speech that tipped him over the line, and if so, how?
It was. I mean, it was back in 2005, October 2005, the Tory Party conference, leadership competition going on at the time. And David Davis was the favourite. And David Cameron was this kind of young underdog, basically hadn't been an MP for very long. And they both delivered their speeches to the Tory Party conference. And overnight, David Cameron became the favourite off the back of this particular speech that you've just played a clip of. And much has been made of it at the time that it kind of turned things around, changed the course of, you know, David Cameron's life, obviously, and also British politics. I think what he did so powerfully in that speech, and actually I went back and listened and reread the David Davis speech, which isn't bad at all. It's pretty well written. If you put them alongside each other, I'd say they're both very well put together. But what Cameron does is he's pretty daring in his approach. He gives the Tory party, you know, some harsh truths. He says Labour have failed, but so have we. And that's, you know, pretty bold for a prospective leader to say to the party faithful. So I think, as with many speeches, you know, the most famous speeches in politics, they're the ones that do something daring, that confound expectations. And that's certainly what Cameron did with that particular speech, whereas David Davis kind of trotted out the same old sort of Tory fare, Tory red meat. He kind of goes through crime and terrorism and talks about drugs and family breakdown. And it's kind of, it's Tory red meat, but it's kind of stale red meat by this point. And David Cameron's coming here with a fresh message and focusing on education and life chances. So he's pretty bold. It was a risk, but it paid off because it totally turned things around for him.
Mm, okay.
It's also theatre, isn't it? Because Davis delivered his in a conventional way behind, on a podium, standing still. Cameron moved around and did it kind of without notes. And it was he was embodying the fact that he was new and young and vigorous in the way he did it as well. So when you read it back, it's a bit ragged, but actually it was brilliant. At the time, a really consequential speech, I think, because it did, I think it won in that contest, and it did change politics in the way most speeches don't. It's harder to trace the impact of some speeches, even Martin Luther King. It's not that easy to trace directly the impact of that speech in particular. But with the Cameron speech, I think it was absolutely directly consequential in winning him that role.
Yeah, I think that's fair. Look, Phil, you'll remember our last speech very well, I'm sure. This is Tony Blair's conference speech in 2006 on the legacy of New Labour.
And the true believer, the true progressive, believes in social justice, in solidarity, in help for those not able to help themselves. They know the race can't just be to the swift and survival for the strong. But they also know that these values, gentle and compassionate as they are, have to be applied in a harsh, uncompromising world. And that what makes the difference is not belief alone, but the raw courage to make it happen.
So, Phil, a quick answer, if you can manage one. But, we've got to move on. But what's the function of a speech like this when it's a speech about a legacy? What are you trying to do? Are you trying to sort of safeguard your own legacy? Or if you're the speaker, or are you trying to sort of leave people reassured at your departure? What's happening?
You're trying essentially to bind in your successors. So you're trying to make an argument that's so compelling that the person who's coming next will accept that tune, that the Tony Blair's only tune, which is you've got to be nice, but you've also got to be realistic, is the only way that Labour Party can win. So that was the essential purpose of that speech.
Mm. Chris, talk us through the process of writing a speech for a Prime Minister. How does it work? Does the Prime Minister come to you with an idea? Do you go to them with an idea? Do you have loads on the sort of the back burner waiting for the right event? What's the process here?
I think every Prime Minister does this differently, as you'd expect, but really that depends on their enthusiasm for actually making speeches in the first place. So to talk to my experience of working with Theresa, she didn't love the process of communicating, really, or making speeches. So when a big speech was coming up, you'd have an initial conversation with her about kind of what the key themes were, but actually she would largely then let the team go off and draft them and come up with something. And that might go through a few drafts before actually something was sent to her. That would often be not long before the speech was actually due to be delivered. I remember one speech in January of 2017 in the USA when she went over to speak at a Republican convention there. And I remember as we were landing in Philadelphia, where the speech was to be delivered, I was still writing the conclusion of the speech as we were coming into land, because such was the sort of busyness of the time. But in that example, it was very much, you know, here's an initial idea, now I'm going to trust you to go away and draft it. And I'd known her for many years, so had that sense of her voice, her speaking style, how she liked things to be written in my head. And so to have that trust was great. But as I say, it came out partly as a result of the fact that she didn't love the process of making speeches and hadn't sort of come up in that way. Whereas I think some other prime ministers who'd been more, I think probably Jess can talk to this, but David Cameron, for example, who'd been a special advisor, who'd probably been a speechwriter at times, probably enjoyed the process a bit more and therefore was a bit more involved than Theresa was.
Well, I mean, Jess, I mean, coming to that, who do you need to sort of get rid of when writing a speech? Who do you need to push out the room and make sure is excluded? And is that sometimes the prime minister themselves?
No. I mean, it was David Cameron was very hands on with speeches, as Chris had said. And you're right, other people kind of tried to get involved as well. But he was quite good at just speaking to the speech writers about the speech. And, you know, if you're holding the pen, you're the one who decides what's going in and what's not. And people, when you circulate these things, they will have their say, as we all know in our experience. And, you know, Peggy Noonan, who Phil referred to earlier, writes about this in her biography, you know, the amount of people that want to have their say and shoehorn their own bits in, but ultimately you're holding the pen. And I was very fortunate to work with a prime minister who, you know, took my drafts and read them and worked on them. And we had lots of back and forth, a bit like Chris is talking about, with drafts via the red box or via email. So he was very straightforward to work with on speeches. Mm. And we didn't have too many arguments about getting rid of people. People would often pipe up, and if there was quite a kind of crunchy line or a punchy or topical line, they'd just try and strike it out and say, oh no, that this is a bit controversial. But, you know, if people are very good at striking things out, very few people can actually come up with decent things themselves. So, you know, that was always my
idea. Phil, are Rishi Sunak and Keir Starmer good speakers, would you say, and how could they be better?
I don't think either of them, you'd say, are wonderful speakers. I mean, both of them are a bit flat. But then that's just who they are.
I mean, I'll put that question to you, Jess, the same question. Are Sunak and Starmer good speakers, and how could they be better?
I think they are. As Phil said, that's just kind of, it's often a bit flat. I mean, we often talk in speeches, you want light and shade. And I feel like often the Prime Minister, Sunak, is all light and Starmer is a bit all shade. They need to have a bit more balance in there and really play to their strengths. As I said, you know, the great speakers really connect with their audiences, and they need to find those kind of points of connection with the people that they're talking to and use language in that way and really avoid jargon. I mean, they fall into the trap. Lots of politicians fall into the trap of using lots of jargon. And really, if they come back to those sort of Martin Luther King principles of making everything concrete and relatable and understandable and things that people can, you know, get to grips with, that would stand them both in good stead to make better speeches.
That's all we've got time for on today's podcast. Matt Chorley will be back tomorrow. And don't forget to share, subscribe, like, and follow wherever you get your podcasts from.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.